people realize. Because without the bees, the pollination wouldn't take place like it's supposed to.
Okay.
Well, are y'all ready to start?
We are ready.
Okay. Well, I'm going to have... Okay, well, I guess y'all just start off telling them about what you do to raise a hive of bees and all the care that's involved with them.
Okay. I am Kathy Cullum, Kathy Thomas Cullum, and my brother Jeff. When we say we've been in beekeeping all our lives, we have literally been in beekeeping all our lives. My dad bought his first beehives when my mom was pregnant with me, and so we've been raised around it. As adults, we've come to learn that a whole lot that we take for granted, that's just common knowledge to us, is unique and unusual to other people. In 1968, our dad decided to make it a full-time living, and he bought a commercial bee business in Lake City, just north on 441 over there, and went into it full-time. And from that day forward, beekeeping is all that he's done. Currently, my husband and I are buying the business on this end from my dad, and our son-in-law has bought the business in North Dakota from dad, and so it is still in the family, still a family operation. My brother and his wife help out anytime they're needed. My nephews are there. Our two adult sons help us out full-time. That's their choice of employment as well, and so we just work it as a family. We have a great time together, but fascinating business to be in, a whole lot of fun. Any family business is a lot of fun.
That's an understatement. Florida generally ranks in the top three honey production states for the entire United States of Florida. United States is probably in the top three or four in the world. All these factors are much like with anything to do with agriculture. All the crops, the amount we produce each year is very much dependent on the weather and several other factors that are involved. Weather being our biggest problem, too much rain, of course, or not enough rain.
Too chilly nights.
Right, can be.
The gallberry just finished up without making any gallberry because the nights were too chilly this year in May.
And if you look at the palmettos around the park, you'll notice the palmettos have some big white blooms on them. Mm-hmm. If they get rained on in the afternoon and it turns off cool that night, it will actually start a blight, which will kill the bloom off before the bees have a chance to make honey on it. We have a lot of crops that generally run together real close. The gallberry, about the time it stops blooming, the palmetto starts. So we have to take great care to rush out there and get the gallberry honey off before the palmetto starts. That's how we're able to separate the different kinds of honey.
A lot of people are used to honey. And we get asked that all the time. We'll ask them, what variety is your favorite? And they'll say, I just like plain honey. And what that is commonly is they take some of the light honeys and some of the dark honeys and they mix it all together and they call it honey. And it is 100% pure honey. But it's just been blended. We at Thomas Honey like to remain flower specific with our top quality honeys. We feel like that each honey has its own unique properties, its own unique flavors, and they're good for different things. I like orange blossom honey in my hot tea, but I like gallberry honey in my coffee. You know, if I'm baking and I don't want to taste honey on the other side, I use clover honey because you can replace honey for sugar using clover honey and you won't change the flavor of whatever you're baking. Just reduce your cooking temperature by about 25 degrees because honey browns faster. So we chase the flower, as we say. We're always chasing the flower.
That's a very difficult process, too. We'll have to go out into the woods, collect all our beehives up, put them in one yard, and get a semi here. We'll load all the bees on a semi and put a net on them. The problems we run into is heat is our biggest problem. Having too many bees in the yard, if it gets hot, they'll start fighting amongst themselves, and they'll actually kill off the weaker hives. So everything's got to go just like clockwork. You got to have your semis lined up and know they're going to be there at a certain time. before you start bunching your bees, because if you put them all together, or for instance, one time we loaded a semi in the middle of the day, it actually got so hot that it melted the wax out of the inside of the combs. The bees circulate air to keep their hives cool, and when they were all stacked together on a truck, that didn't allow enough circulation of air around the outside of the hive, and we lost several hives just because it actually got that hot.
It melted.
Melted.
So you take the hives to the fields?
Yes, sir. When we go on long trips to North Dakota, for instance, or to South Florida, we'll put them on a semi. We've got a big screen custom fit to the exact side that we just put right over the top, zip it up, put straps on it, and away they go. Then they'll be unloaded in one central yard. We'll come with smaller trucks and distribute them out into the fields.
Bees find their way back from to the hive once they've gone from Florida to North Dakota.
That is one of the most fascinating entities to me. A bee will have 40, 60, 80 hives in one yard, and the bee knows which hive is hers. She orients herself by sight and by smell. And I love to take these little observation hives home and pop the lid out, the doorway out, and watch them, and the little bees will actually come out, and they'll make little circles this way, and then they'll come back, and then they'll make little circles this way, and then she'll just take off and go. She's figured out where her house is at, and she'll come back to that. We move our bees late at night or early in the morning, or if the temperature is cold. In North Dakota, they can actually move them if it's too windy. It doesn't get that windy down here, but up there, it'll get sometimes 35 miles an hour winds blowing, and they can move them when it's windy like that. The bees won't fly out of their house if it's rainy or dark or too windy.
Now, I know that bees are important for pollinating plants. Do y'all ever rent your hives out to farmers to help get their
Yes, we do.
Pollinated?
That has become a bigger and bigger business for us, particularly here in Florida. There's a lot of produce grown in Florida, and 70%, I think, of all produce grown requires some kind of pollination. And they can increase their yield incredibly by accessing the right number of hives. Cucumbers, for instance, I believe 110% greater yield just by putting the right number of hives on the field. We actually start our year out in January down in South Florida on pollination contracts. We usually rent anywhere from 200 to 700, 800 hives on pollination. Sometimes that overlaps a little bit with the orange blossom, and the bees would a lot rather fly to the orange blossom flower than to a squash plant. And we have a little bit of trouble in South Florida. This guy's trying to grow squash, and his neighbor has got orange trees, and we've witnessed the bees just flying right over the top of the squash going to the orange groves. So that can be difficult. But so the orange crop follows the pollination contract in South Florida. From there, we move them up here to North Florida, where we work again some pollination contracts, and also to the gallberry and the wildflower. In June, we go to North Dakota. They go up there for the summer. We keep some bees down here. We do a lot of maintenance and repair work on our equipment and all. In September, they all start coming home again. We go back to pollination contracts again in South Florida. And work some of those again in the fall. So
that's just one example of many different facets of beekeeping. Honey production is only one of the things. There are people that collect pollen for medicinal purposes. They collect royal jelly for medicinal purposes. Some people simply sell bees by the pound. They grow bees and sell packaged bees.
They sell queens. A queen runs about $11 or $12 a piece.
So I can give a box of bees to my brother.
Yes, you can.
Sure. The reason pollination has become such a big business for the farmers, for the beekeepers, is the farmers tend to spray a lot of long-term pesticides. Liquid 7 is one of the worst. It won't kill the bee within 48 hours. And during that amount of time, the bee has placed it in the food system, which is fed to all the young bees and also to the queen bees. So if the queen should get a hold of a little bit of the honey with the Liquid 7 in it, or another pesticide, if we lose the queen, we pretty much lose the hive. It's almost impossible to back up. But it will reduce the health of the hive across the board. And we go to great lengths to try to stay in close touch with the farmers. If they're going to spray a field, we can usually move our bees out for 48 hours, and we're safe to move them back in. But it's juggling. It's juggling a lot of bees around, a lot of shuffling.
Well, you talked about the maintenance aspect of it. about what a, how a hive is put together and how you keep it in shape.
There are several ways to start out if you're a hobbyist interested in having a hive or two. It is a great and fascinating hobby. It is also sometimes a painful hobby, and it is a labor-intensive hobby. They are alive, and they have to keep. They have to go through regimens to keep them healthy and well, more so now even than 30, 40 years ago. And in fact, one of the things our dad struggles with is the systematic management that is required in a honeybee colony now, in a honeybee operation. You can start out, the best place I tell people to go to start out, particularly in this area, is our local bee supply company. And they're in High Springs, Florida. And they have everything from the little book that says how to, or the video if you'd rather watch it on TV, to the actual bees that you can buy. You can buy a package and put them into your own hive that you maybe built yourself, but you had to get the equipment there at Datant. Or you can buy the hive from Datant already set up and ready to go. Usually it'll run you right around $150 for that. You absolutely will need a smoker, hive tool, hat, and veil. I actually know hobbyists that have come and bought beehives without that equipment. He ended up giving it back to me a year later because he never got around to buying that stuff. So you've got your bees, you get them home, and what you have is this section down here is your hive body. They're usually 8 frames wide or 10 frames wide. This observation hive here is set up solely for the purpose that you folks can look at them without having to worry about getting bee stung. In a real operation, it would look similar to this. We run ours on pallets. You'll see those sometimes in fields. Instead of just being a beehive, you'll see 4 hives to a set, and that's because we use a front-end loader to move things around. Obviously, we don't want to run 1,600 hives one hive at a time. So,
one of the most interesting things that is not shown in this picture, we use a wire mesh, and it's called an excluder. And what that does is excludes the queen from going upstairs.
Or downstairs.
Above this. She's slightly larger than the regular worker bees. So by using the screen, we're able to keep all
this
the brood and all the eggs in the bottom half of the hive, and all the honey production goes on in the top of the hive.
Right.
That's very important because you don't want to get brood mixed in with your honey, and you don't want to accidentally take your queen away while you're robbing a super of honey off the top. So it's very important that we keep her down in the bottom. She does all her business down there. All the queen does is lay eggs. She doesn't even feed herself.
She can lay, on average, about 1,600 eggs a day. She can be pushed to lay more by feeding her and releasing pheromones that she understands. They can encourage her to lay more, but she can't keep that up for a very long period of time. 2-3 weeks, and she kind of gets exhausted. If she's trying to lay 2,000 or 3,000 eggs a day, that's kind of pushing her a little bit. But on a good average day, she can easily lay about 1,600.
She will control the amount of eggs she lays according to how much honey is coming in the hive.
Right.
Once she sees a honey flow starting and they're starting to make honey, she'll bring her egg production up, and when the honey flow's over, she'll slow it back down again. So that's
so
the way she does it.
You have your little hive, you've brought it home, what do you do with it now? The first thing you're probably going to need to do is grow it up a little bit because it's brand new. It's probably not completely full of bees, and so you may feed it a little bit of corn syrup that you can again get at the Datant dealership. We've been known in situations to mix our own kind of batch. We'll fill a quart jar with sugar and add a little bit of water and some honey so that it tastes like what they want it to taste like and feed bees that. So you can do that in an emergency. These bees are going to need to be medicated. You never medicate if you want a good pure product. You never medicate while they're on a honey flow. They're going to have to be treated for mites. One of the greatest systems that we have in the state of Florida is our state bee inspection system. I tell people it's one government entity that actually works for us. I recommend to everybody that they get involved with their state bee inspector. Whether you have one hive or 1,500 or 3,000 or whatever you're running, they come out and they open your hives with you and dig in your hives with you, and they will tell you what's going on with your hive. They will offer advice and tips. They can keep you up to date on the latest advances in medications and diseases and everything. They're just a great bunch of guys to work with. So if you're interested in it as a hobby, I strongly recommend that you register your hive with the state and take advantage of that program.
You mentioned bee mites. That sounds kind of like the bees would have fleas or something.
That's exactly what it's like.
What are the bee
mites? Right. The two major mites that we're affected by, one is microscopic. The other is clearly visible, a bright red dot on the back. The microscopic bee will get in their trachea. It's called a trachea mite, and it makes it hard for them to breathe. And the way we can find that mite usually is by what we call K-wing. Their little wings kind of lift up off their back, and that's because they're struggling for breath, and they don't have enough energy to hold their wings down flat. The varroa mite is by far and away a worser plague. Not only can she kill the hive, but she carries with her a host of viruses that even though you might get your varroa mite under control, you may still lose your hive to one of the many viruses that she carries.
And how do you treat them for the mites?
Right now, what we're using is a brand new product. Every time they come out with something and we get it approved for use, it's safe in the United States of America. We take for granted that all this stuff is, you know, that all this stuff has been tested. In other countries, they don't test. But we're using a method right now that it looks kind of like Vaseline, and you smear it on a little piece of cardboard and stick it in the top of the hive. And you have to do that again 10 days later. So you can imagine that's pretty labor-intensive for 1,500 colonies that we're running.
The varroa mite will actually be about the size of the dot on the back of the bee. It's very clearly visible. It looks just like a tick on the back of
that
bee.
And that's theoretically what it is. It's a tick on a bee.
Yep.
And they also can be affected by American fowl brood, European fowl brood, Nosema. Those are just diseases or fungi that can affect the bee. And those are, again, things that you treat for periodically, or if you see the disease, you treat for it. And, again, it's really important in our way of thinking that you do this around a honey flow, even to the degree that if your hive is ailing and there is a honey flow, you just bypass that honey flow in that hive. You don't put stuff on your bees whenever you're trying to make honey, if you're trying to make a good, pure product. You know?
And how long does it take for the hive to... for the honey flow to get to the point of harvest in it?
About 3 to 6 weeks, usually. A lot of people are under the impression that you can buy a beehive and stick it in your backyard and it's just going to make honey. And that's really not true. There are only a limited number of flowers that produce honey or produce the right kind of nectar that the bee can make honey from it. And of those flowers... there's, what, 3 major crops in the state of Florida? 4 if you count Melaleuca, but who wants to count Melaleuca? nasty honey, really bad honey. And so that, you know, it depends on where you are. If you're in North Florida, for instance, and you have an area like this and you set a hive of bees here, you're going to make gallberry honey and palmetto honey and maybe something in the summer.
Maybe some cabbage palm.
Maybe a little bit of cabbage
palm. Maybe some cabbage palm. Spanish needle. The little stickers that get on your clothes and stuff. The plant grows about this high, has white flowers and all. Bees actually make a lot of honey off of that. It's not real tasty honey, but it actually do. We make a little honey off of maple trees. Watermelons produce a little bit of honey, but bees will actually work the watermelon juice. If the melon stays in the field long enough to bust open like they sometimes will, the bees will actually get out there and get the juice out of
them. They love that watermelon juice.
They love watermelons.
So how long does it take for the bees to make enough honey to harvest?
The gallberry crop will run about 3 weeks. Now the bees are going to be bringing nectar in steady during that time, and the way they bring nectar in is inside of a special stomach that's inside of them. It's called their honey stomach. And while that nectar is in their honey stomach, while they're in flight, enzymes are released into that honey stomach. When they get back to the hive, they deposit it into the cell. It's not honey yet, it's nectar with enzymes. They have to fan it and cure it until it reduces the moisture. If you take your honey off too soon, it's what we call green, or it's too runny, or it's too high in moisture, however you want to say it, and it'll sour. It'll actually ferment in the jar. And so you need to give it towards the end of the season. You can sometimes, you know, 3 weeks into it, you can sometimes pull all but maybe the top super and give that top super a little bit more time to finish curing. And so 3 weeks maybe, and on an average season, the gallberry, for instance, you're going to get two to four supers of honey during that time.
Two to four what? Supers. Supers?
Now that's this shallow box right here. This is a super frame in the top part of this observation hive.
This is a brood nest frame where all the brood's at. We call that the brood nest. I don't know how much more time we got, but I'm sure y'all got some questions. I see some people out there with so if anyone would like to ask any questions, we'll go ahead and answer them.
I've got a question.
All right.
Another one. All right, so you pull the hives out of the honey, or the supers out of the hive. Now, how do you...
We pull the entire super. The frames are what's in the super. And we pull the entire super. And we use a really interesting little board that's called a robin board. And we spray this stinky chemical on it. That's its only purpose, is to stink. That's the only thing it does. Never touches the honey, but it stinks. And the bees think so too. And they run away from that smell. So they run down to their brood chamber. Well, they're going to hesitate there because that's where all of their babies are. And then you pull that board off, you pull those supers off with the frames in them, and you go back to your honey house.
Okay, so you've got the honey within the wax comb, right?
Mm-hmm.
So how do you separate the honey from the comb?
This was called extracting.
Okay,
the extracting process. Here, we got a picture here somewhere, maybe.
Yeah. I don't think so.
We didn't bring that one. Okay. What we got here, these cells on this beehive, although they look entirely level, they're not. They're actually angled up a little bit like that. So as they start filling it with honey, they can start bridging across the top there, and they can completely pack the whole tank full and get it full. So what we have to do to get the honey out is to remove that layer of wax. In the old days, they would just heat a knife and take a knife and cut the wax itself off. Well, now we have a machine called an uncapper that removes the cappings, and then we'll put it in a
from
large...
From both sides of the frame.
Right,
the
from both sides
time.
Of the frame at the same time. It saves beekeepers slick. A lot of time when they figure out how to build this machine. Then we have a large cylinder that with a frame inside of it that we stick all these frames down into, and it spins around in a circle. It simply slings the honey out of the frame up against
like your
the
washing
wall.
Machine on the spin cycle.
Right, just like a washing machine, basically. And spins it all out. It's got a drain in the bottom. We drain it over to a tank and pump it up.
That allows us to retain the integrity of this frame. The frame is then dry, or is still pretty sticky, but it's got most of the honey out of it, and the wax is all still there. So we can give it back to the bee for the next crop.
Okay, so you don't use the wax from the comb for candles?
Yes, all that we cut off, those wax caps, goes into a vat. It's a gooey, sticky, wax and honey mess, and it goes into a vat that has hot pipes running through it, and it melts the wax, and when the wax melts, it separates from the honey.
The wax is lighter than honey, and it will float to the top, whether it's melted or not. By heating it up, we speed the process up.
Right.
It also allows us to drain the wax off of the top of the honey, and we have a float system that allows when the honey level gets up to a certain level and we have a layer of wax on top, we can open the valve down here and it lets just the wax run out, but it leaves the honey in the tank. So that's how we separate the wax.
On a hobbyist level, you have a couple of options. One is you can take your frame into your house, cut it out, wax and all, and squeeze that through cheesecloth. Then you're going to end up with this blob, that sticky, gooey wax and honey mess. You can put that into a double boiler and do the same thing that we just talked about. Whenever it melts, it'll separate, and whenever you let it cool back down, the wax will form a cake on the top, the honey will be underneath, but it'll be a nice hard cake of wax that you can use to make candles or lotions or all kinds of great things. You can also use the hot knife method. You can still buy an old hot knife that plugs into the wall, and you just take the cappings off the frames, and you can get a hand-turn extractor that'll hold just three or four frames, and you just stand there at your kitchen table and turn it. Same process. It spins the honey out. Or you can get small electric extractors that may hold 10 or 12 or 15 frames. Ours actually will hold 100 frames. And we have one that holds 80 frames. I don't know. A bunch, anyways.
So do you all make the candles yourself or sell the wax to people who make candles? How big a part of the wax is y'all's business?
I strictly like to hand dip candles as a hobby. We don't market them. Most of our wax is sold back to, like, Daydant, for instance. We can trade that wax in on equipment and stuff that we need. They give us a dollar value on it. And so most of our wax gets turned in.
Well, it sounds like y'all really work the bees hard. You rent them out to farmers, and you sell the honey, and you trade the wax for
And in addition, we do a lot of custom extracting for other commercial beekeepers. We have the bottle business that we run. So we run several. The only way the American farm can, a small farmer can survive in today's world is to diversify. And so we try to run several different entities within our company that keeps us vibrant, hopefully.
Well, I don't often think of the beekeeper as a small farmer, but I'm going to think of them. I'll think of them like that from now on.
Yeah, absolutely. And I tell people, you know, farmers are the world's greatest gamblers. We gamble every day when we get up. You know, we gamble on whether or not we're going to have a crop, whether or not all that money we invested in getting our bees to the location and getting the supers on them and going through all of that, whether or not it's going to pay off in the long run. And so,
yeah. I'm afraid we take the farmers for granted when we go to the grocery store to get our food, but if it weren't for the farmers, we'd all be pretty hungry.
Yep. That's true.
Well,
that's very true.
Does anybody have any questions here? I'm sure there are some.
Yeah, you said it's significantly more difficult now as opposed to 30 years ago. What's the difference?
The difference is by shipping bees internationally, that we've managed to pick up parasites and diseases from other countries now. And now, whereas a disease or a particular kind of mite or beetle might be located in one region, now it's generally all over the world. The African hive beetle was introduced to the United States in 98, I think it was. Within 3 years, it has spread throughout the entire industry. There's not a beekeeper in the United States that doesn't have to deal with that problem now.
The Varroa mite, they believe, came in on some queens that were illegally imported. It hit the United States wide within just a few months span.
Yes.
But, for instance, my dad's Aunt Gussie, who introduced my dad to beekeeping, had three or four hives that sat in her backyard year-round, and she took the honey off of them. And that's about all Aunt Gussie did. And my dad helped her rob the honey. And those hives just lived there peacefully in the back corner of the yard. She didn't have to worry about medicating them and doctoring them. And you know, she didn't worry about feeding them. And she just didn't worry about them except to go and take the honey off of them when it was time.
You simply cannot do that now. Your beehive will be dead within 3 months if you don't go into it and stay on top of it. You really need to go into it every 4 to 6 weeks. You need to be in there poking around.
At least.
For each hive.
Yeah. At least, yeah.
So by the time we get through with 1,600, we just start over again. And we constantly going through them now.
Right.
And it really is real labor intensive. If you had cows, for example, and now all of a sudden you've got to bring your cows, you've got to round them all up and bring them all in and do, you know, three or four extra times a year, then that's the problem we're faced with, you know.
Yeah. We have another question. Have you had any opportunity to show up in your areas?
Not specifically in our area. We have a lot of hybrids that have shown up in Florida. They're Africanized honeybees that have interbred with our domesticated Italian, Caucasian strains, European honeybee. And what we get is a real ornery hive. We haven't found anything that we couldn't handle. We actually have seen incidences of this and dealt with it for 10 years or better. But
the further north they move, the more they tend to interbreed with the domesticated bees, and it brings their aggression level down quite a bit. Another factor is weather. They really can't do cold weather at all, not even close to what these guys can take. Because they're originally from Africa. And so we're kind of safe as long as we get these cooler winters, you know. And the other problem, going back to what I said about the long-term pesticides that are being applied, has virtually eliminated wild bees in any heavily agriculture-related area.
Yeah, the bees need a beekeeper now in today's world. The bees need a beekeeper. So we kind of help each other. They help us and we help them.
Yeah.
But did you know that Africanized honeybees are not a natural phenomenon? They are a man-made bee. They were developed to produce more honey, but in the development, when they started tinkering with the genetics, they made a loose wire.
We use Italian bees, which, as far as bees go, are about halfway up the level on the amount of honey they can produce, but they're way up there on gentleness,
on
being able to handle them without getting stung. African bees were way up on the amount of honey that they could produce. Scientists felt if they could cross the two together, they would get a bee with a mild temper that would produce great amounts of honey. They wound up with the exact opposite thing. A killer bee. Yes.
Yep. Any other questions?
The gentleman at the table had a question a minute ago.
He said we answered it when we got
okay,
his question.
Okay, cool. Okay.
Water lilies
produce some pollen that is beneficial to the bee. The honeybee needs not only the nectar from the flower, but the pollen from flowers. They're two different food sources for them.
Right. And a lot of flowers that look real attractive, a bee can't work. Azaleas, for example, right, have such a long throat on the blossom of the flower that the bee can't get down in there to it, which is God's way of making sure the butterflies get to eat, too. You know what I mean? It's interesting. Flowers that you think that they would make lots of honey on, they don't necessarily do. And other real insignificant flowers. One of my favorite honey is gallberry, which blooms in this area. It's just a little old plant that grows right out in the middle of that stuff. Has a little tiny bloom that big. You hardly even notice them. But the bees really make a lot of honey on them. So it's hard to say. Some blooms that look like they would do great, they really don't. Some of them, you know.
Well, we are doing taste of honey over at the table. Many of you might have already gotten to try that. We'll let you taste the different varieties of
honey.
They're
all good.
We have a local route that we run that's within about a 100-mile radius that I developed several years ago. It covers Jacksonville, St. Augustine, Alachua, Madison, and that route. We also ship. We have a website. I have some business cards up here, and you guys are welcome to take a business card. Feel free to contact me. You can email me if you have questions. If you want to know more about the Day Dance Supply Company, I would love to share their information with you because they're friends of mine. Just drop me an email and tell me you want to know about the Bee Supply Company, and I'll give you their name and number. I'll help you out any way I can. It's an awesome hobby. It is a labor-intensive hobby, but it is an amazing hobby. Yeah, I never tire of learning new stuff
Woody
about him.
How many people know Woody that's here that runs the beer garden? Okay.
Yep.
All right, tell them about Woody.
What about Woody?
Oh, yeah, he's going to sell you his bees.
Yeah, Woody Woodard is actually getting out of the bee business. He's had some knee trouble and stuff. He's selling us his entire operation, 200-plus hives and all the stuff to go with it. But he said there was one condition if he sold me the bees. I had to let him come and work his bees sometime. I said, you got it. I don't even have to pay him.
Well, I want to thank y'all for coming out and sharing
your
information about bees. Yep. And y'all stay tuned because we're going to have a blueberry pie eating contest up here. Woo-hoo! And it's not too late to sign up.
Turn.